Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. Well, February is American Heart Month, and last month we examined the link between heart disease and stroke. And today we're continuing to raise awareness because it seems that heart disease, even though we know it exists, gets a lot less publicity than other illnesses. For example, it's well documented that 1 in 30 American women die of breast cancer, and that's a significant number, but as many as 1 in 3 American women die of heart disease. Heart disease is the number one killer of women, age 20 plus, and it kills one woman every single minute. So in light of that connection between inflammation and disease, we're going to start today's show with Dr. Victoria Bowman, who will share how to get our GI system in good health. And around 12:20, we'll be joined by cardiologist Dr. Robert Davidson. He was included in the Best Doctors in America list and selected as one of America's top physicians by the Consumers Research Council of America. And he's devoted his whole 30-year career to cardiology. Dr. Davidson is going to share the latest medical news on heart disease and what we can do to protect our heart. And we'll end today by getting close up and personal with a young woman who lives in Seattle, Brandy Aubrey. She'll share her journey with heart disease. She's lived with it her whole life and survived open heart surgery, and she's just 34 years old today. So I want to welcome, first of all, Dr. Victoria Bowman to the show. She's a healthcare professional, author and speaker with more than 30 years of expertise in cleansing, detoxification, digestive and gastrointestinal GI health. And Dr. Bowman received a PhD in homeopathy and natural medicine from Westbrook University and a doctorate in homeopathic medicine from the British Institute of Homeopathy in London. She's the author of You Gotta Have Guts, The Natural Way to Enhance GI Health. And I want to welcome you to the show, Dr. Victoria Bowman.
Well, thank you so much. It's delightful to be here.
Well, one of the reasons I wanted to talk with you, because you are an expert in this subject, and I myself have heard a lot of conflicting information about probiotics and GI health and all that good stuff. I think most of us know that 60% of our immune system is in our gut, as we call it. So let's begin with specifically what we mean by our gut and what that 60% of our immune system means to our body.
Okay, well, when we look at our GI tract, it starts with our mouth and ends with our anus. And the first foot of our GI tract is actually our mouth and our esophagus, so where we swallow, and it goes to our stomach. And then our stomach doesn't take a lot of space. So the next 22 feet is the small intestines. And within the small intestines, we have pyre patches. And that's primarily the part of the immune system that is in the intestines. Then there's a little valve that goes between the small intestine and the large intestine called the ileocecal valve. And it's designed so that material can't back up into the small intestines once it's passed through this valve. And it dumps into the bowl of the cecum. That's at the bottom right part of our body. And that's where our appendix is located. We come up across to the left side down, and then there's a little loop there that's called an S-loop or the sigmoid colon. And that's the last 5 feet of our intestinal tract. And there's many functions that go on there. A lot of people think of our large intestine as just a trash can, and that isn't so. When we have it healthy and with the correct probiotics or intestinal bacteria, we can actually manufacture certain nutrients like B12 and vitamin K. We also can absorb nutrients that maybe our small intestines missed because we have leaky gut or something like that going on or impaired digestion. We also have the ability, with the correct balance, to bind to toxic debris that may have been in the food. Let's say you got something with some insecticide or pesticide or something like that. It can bind to that so that we can actually eliminate it and not have it make our body more toxic by poisoning us. And then also, our colon is the original recycling plant. It recycles water and bile. And then at that point, it decomposes food stuff into fecal material, so it's a compost pit. And then we take out the trash. It's got a big job.
It does have a big job, and it kind of helps putting it in that analogy there. My great-grandmother always used to say every ailment, every single ailment was, you need a good clear out. and she's not too, she wasn't too far from the truth, I think. But if we have, if our GI tract is out of whack, if we've got more bad bacteria than good flora, how do we, what kind of symptoms might we see?
Well, gas and bloating are very frequent symptoms that people will talk about. There can be pain in part of the colon, whether it's the lower right side or left side or actually all the way across. We've even seen individuals that have difficulty holding low back chiropractic adjustments. They're actually full of poo.
Oh.
And it's pressing on the back from the inside.
Right, right. So we're looking for an optimal balance. I've looked at your book and other information on the immune system. We're looking for an optimal balance, I believe, of about 85% good bacteria and 15% bad. And normally our body is very, very good at sorting this all out, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
But if we're feeling off whack and, you know, good health does start here, seems to originate from here, then... there's a lot of conflicting information out there, and this is what I really wanted to talk to you about today, because I've heard a lot of information on probiotics. Yes, they're good for you. Others doctors say, you know what, you can maybe do a little bit more harm than good. They might help you, might not. You might do more harm than good, because we can't really measure the incidence of what's in the body versus what we're putting in with the probiotics. So talk to us a little about that, if you would.
Well, there are some people that are very sensitive. And in those cases, I would say one might need to be careful with the probiotics that you introduce. However, they're a very small percentage. And they generally will talk about environmental, chemical, or electromagnetic sensitivity. But other than that, many of our labs are producing very well-maintained and established standards for probiotics, and I don't have fear of those at all. I've seen just the opposite, that it promotes health. A number of years ago, someone came to me, and she had a lot of yeast, candida, and she had no healthy probiotics, and her physician had given her probiotics by mouth over and over and over, and she didn't respond. Well, I do a treatment that actually introduces it from the bottom up. And it's very easy and it's very simple and you can do it for yourself. So she came to me for one colon hydrotherapy because she did suffer from constipation. And then we did this little treatment called reflorestation. And 10 days later, her doctor ran another stool test to see, and her fecal material was filled with healthy probiotics. It was just amazing. And it maintained that way over the course of time. So, you know, I look and go, whereas there might be a very rare case, sure, but what we have available today, I think, has high standards and is very safe.
Right. So normally when somebody comes to you and says, you know, I'm feeling off, out of whack, where do you begin with them?
Well, the first thing I need to do is, again, talk about the symptoms, because it's like playing Sherlock Holmes. We need to find out, are they chewing their food well? Because you start digestion in the mouth. Our saliva is actually salivary amylase enzyme, and that starts the digestion of carbohydrates. And so many people gobble and swallow that they do not digest their food because they don't start in the right place, and that's chewing. And then we need to look at, well, after you eat, are you uncomfortable 20 minutes after you eat or 2 hours after you eat? Or what kind of symptoms do you have and when do you have them? and then, of course, find out if they have burping and belching, or if they have, you know, flatulence. Are they passing their gas rectally or orally? And by going through these things, we can find where their primary digestive problem is, and then we begin there. I think everyone, I had an instance just recently, my swimming pool was constipated. And, you know, I thought I was pretty good at taking care of it. And what happened was we couldn't get it to stay clean. And I had forgotten when I spoke with the pool man about 3 years ago and learned everything I was supposed to learn, that he said you need to actually clean the filter every 3 to 4 times a year. And I spoke with my son and I said, I just forgot. We need to do that. Well, he took it apart and he emailed me a picture of it, and it was like, oh my gosh, the filter was constipated. It was packed practically to the top with dirt and diatomaceous earth.
Oh, wow.
Wow, and we had one ruined filter. And so he cleaned everything out. He replaced the one bad one. He put it back together. He put in the right amount, the correct amount of the right stuff, DE. And in 6 hours, the pool was sparkling. And I thought, that sounds like our guts. It sounds like our guts. My pool was constipated.
The body is such a mystery still in so many ways. I'm guessing that it's a matter of trial and error when you're working with someone to get the right balance.
It is, but it isn't. And the reason is we have hundreds of different varieties of bacteria. Actually, there's thousands. But within our GI tract, there's hundreds. And there are, let's say, a few dozen that are present in just about everybody. And so what we know is that when we put in the major players in an amount and a method that they can establish themselves, we can actually, you know, just make a 180, and we can get the digestive tract, the lower tract, the elimination to correct itself and begin functioning very efficiently, very rapidly.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk a little bit about fiber? Because I know, you know, people think, oh, I'm having my fiber, but it's not quite as simple as that, is it? We have to have enough water and the right kind of fiber.
Absolutely. Fiber is important, and I always encourage people to get fiber from their food. However, again, we have to individualize. And the difficulty is that some people eat tremendous amounts of fiber and they still don't have easy bowel elimination. And what I've found is I'm not a fan of bran. Bran, if you do not have enough water, then I'm just going to say it's kind of like cement. And psyllium is another fiber that's available. And if you have a product that's all psyllium, 100% psyllium, then a person will notice more bowel gas and more bowel bloating. So I prefer, if they want to use the psyllium, that they find a combination that has other things like soy fiber and oat bran and things like that. However, if they're celiac, if they have a gluten sensitivity, they need to be careful. Then there's another product out there, and it actually is inulin, and it's made from the chicory plant, and it's oftentimes combined with gargum, and it's an amazing fiber. I use it for both constipation and diarrhea because it is a bowel modulator. So if a person has diarrhea, it helps the stool form up and slow down going through so nutrition can be assimilated and then eliminated easily. And if a person is constipated, it speeds things up and it makes the stool, instead of being hard like marbles or something like that, then it makes it more like firm applesauce. And so, it doesn't have the side effect. Oh, don't you love my analogies?
I'm never going to look at applesauce the same.
Well, you should see how I feel about mustard.
Oh, what was the name of that product again? Or that
product, the actual name is called True Fiber, TRUFIBER.
Okay.
And it's, you know, many of the better health food stores or the health food supermarkets carry it. If not, they can find it.
Okay. Now, I know when I went for a test a year or so back, I was talking with a doctor there and asking her questions about fiber and stuff on something I was working on. And she said then that prunes, you know, a lot of people rely on things like prunes, and that's not a good idea. Do you agree with that?
Well, I agree if it's done on a daily basis. Occasionally, we have to turn to things, but those are things that constantly force the bowel to work, and I would rather encourage the bowel to work.
Okay, so looking at our diet then, how do we do that as naturally as possible?
Again, you know, fibrous foods, and dried fruit are fibrous foods, so again, making them a part of the diet is a good thing to do, just not doing it every day. I think food rotation is important. We know that grains have good fiber, and we just need to be careful that it's not a grain that a person has an allergy or an intolerance to. Obviously, vegetables are filled with fiber, as are fruits. So the foods that don't have a lot of fiber, or actually little to none, are animal proteins or proteins such as an egg, and then also fats. They're okay. Important for our diet, but they don't count towards fiber.
Okay, a lot of interesting information in here. You've had a very interesting background, this is all converged into what you do at work. It's very interesting. So final thought that you'd like to leave our listeners with, Dr. Bowman?
I think the most important thing is, if you don't take care of your body, where are you going to live? And take your life lightly, but be serious about taking care of your health.
Yeah, very good. And you obviously have a sense of humor. That comes across in your book. So if anybody's interested in learning more about the natural way to enhance GI health, Dr. Bowman's book is You Gotta Have Health. Dr. Victoria Bowman, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, and thank you so much. Have a wonderful day.
Thanks. And please do stay with us. We're going to take a very quick break. And when we come up, we're going to be talking with Dr. Robert Davidson about heart disease. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
If you want to reach a large audience of like-minded people, people with integrity, people who strive to live well and live strong, let Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair shine a spotlight on your message. Tell us about your business, product, service, or event, and we'll help you craft your message and promote your good work. Email Vicki at conversationslive.net or call 425-269-4772. That's 425-269-4772. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Join us live every Monday at noon on Alternative Talk 1150 or stream live from conversationslive.net.
Stay informed with news, traffic, and weather at the top of the hour, weekdays on Alternative Talk 1150 AM.
Throw away, throw away, throw away the trash.
And welcome back, everyone. Eric's getting caught up on this throwaway the trash analogy. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clara, and my next guest is Dr. Robert Davidson. He is a board-certified cardiologist and internist. He's been practicing in the Los Angeles area for over 30 years. Dr. Davidson did his fellowship in cardiology at Duke University Medical Center. He became the clinical chief of cardiology at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center and has been on the clinical faculty of UCLA Medical Center, where he was appointed clinical professor of medicine at the David Geffen UCLA School of Medicine. He is a fellow of the American Heart Association, American College of Cardiology, and American College of Physicians. And he was included in the Best Doctors in America and selected as one of America's top physicians by the Consumers Research Council of America. Welcome to the show, Dr. Davidson.
Thank you very much. A pleasure.
Well, I want to begin, first of all, because you've dedicated 30 years of your life to cardiology, and I'm always interested why people pick the path they take, or did it pick you? What made you get into cardiology?
I was influenced, I think, mostly in my second year of medical school when I attended, at that time I was at New York University School of Medicine in Bellevue Hospital, and we had a wonderful cardiology clinic that I was privileged to attend, and we had some wonderful professors and some fascinating patients. And at that time, the ability to diagnose complex conditions purely by history and physical examination and come up with a sophisticated diagnosis that could then be tested by various means that was extremely appealing. We did have some treatments at that time, but in retrospect, the treatments that we had were primitive compared to what we have available today. So if I were to do it all over again, I certainly would have picked the same specialty, but perhaps for somewhat different reasons, because now I think the wonderful thing about the field is that there's so much that we can do, both in terms of treatment and prevention, that were not available 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah, I was actually staggered when I was doing my research for the show, just how much information is available to us now. I was also shocked by how many different aspects of heart disease there are. So I guess I want to look for today's show at the most common aspects of heart disease, because it is a very specialized, very specialized subject. So could we look at, you know, the basics of what we mean by heart disease and what the risk factors are?
Right. Well, heart disease does take many forms. The type of heart disease that we deal with most of the time, and that is the most common form in the world and in the United States, is coronary heart disease. And that is the condition, in fact, that accounts for the majority of deaths in the country, both in men and women. And that's also the area where the biggest strides have been made, both, again, in treatment and prevention.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still a major, major problem. As I say, it does account for the majority of mortality. Far more deaths due to cardiovascular disease than to every other form of disease combined.
Yes, that was shocking. I saw that on your website. So let's look at the risk factors. I know obesity,
sure.
Lack of exercise, high blood pressure. What are we talking about there?
Well, all of those and more. Interestingly, both the mortality from heart disease and the actual occurrence of heart disease, the amount of heart attacks we're seeing have declined fairly dramatically over the last 30 years and continue to decline. And it's felt that that's due to a combination of recognition and treatment of risk factors as well as better treatment for the disease itself. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to control all the risk factors. The one risk factor that I think we'll never have control over is heredity.
Mm-hmm.
So like in many other things, choosing your parents properly can be very important. But that aside, the other risk factor, of course, is age. So we're seeing a increasing aging population. And as the population ages, the prevalence of heart disease does actually increase because it is, for the most part, a disease of older individuals.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, from a positive standpoint, we've recognized the importance of treating high blood pressure, the importance of treating high cholesterol and other lipid abnormalities, and the importance of stopping smoking, the importance of exercise, the importance of weight control. Unfortunately, that's the one that has been the least well applied. And as you know, we're seeing an increasing obesity epidemic in the country, and particularly among children and younger adults. And that stands to perhaps start leveling off and even reversing the positive trends that we've seen in reduction of heart disease over the last 30, 40 years.
Mm. So, and I also read that genetics, African-American and Hispanic-American Latino women tend to have a propensity toward heart disease more than Caucasian.
That's correct. And it's also the case that that group in general tends to I have a little cold today, have less access to medical care, take advantage of the system less, and perhaps are not treated as aggressively as the majority population, the Caucasian male population. So I think it's a combination of hereditary factors and perhaps a combination of both patient selected decrease in doctor visits and availability by the medical profession to see some of the lowest socioeconomic classes. So you're absolutely right. That is a major national concern, epidemiologic concern.
Right. So, and I wanted to talk a little bit more about blood pressure because I read on your website that more Americans visit their physician for the management of hypertension than for any other disease-specific reason. And that compared to people with normal blood pressure, people with hypertension are three times more likely to develop coronary heart disease. So, you know, other than take medication, what can we do to lower our blood pressure? And what should it be? Because there, again, I found differing numbers.
Well, there have been a lot of advances in this over the years. Thinking back to when I went to medical school, it wasn't even clear whether or not high blood pressure needed to be treated. That was still being discussed and argued. That's subsequently certainly been well established. There's still some argument as to what is the ideal blood pressure, although even that's becoming a lot more clear. I think the major problem is in recognition of high blood pressure and inadequate treatment, so that there's still a great many people out in the population who have not been to the doctor's office or have not been coming on a regular basis, and hypertension is developing with neither the patient's knowledge or the doctor's knowledge. And one of the problems with hypertension is that it's a silent killer because it usually doesn't cause side effects, cause symptoms. So that many people can be walking around with quite high blood pressures and be totally unaware of it. So the first aspect is recognition. Once they're in the doctor's office, it gets easier. So getting them in is the first step.
Right.
And then adequate control, of course. Now, what you bring up the question, what is adequate control? We used to think that 140 over 90 is the upper limit of normal, and it's still, strictly speaking, the definition of true hypertension. But we recognize that the risk from blood pressure is incremental. So anything higher than really 110 or 115 systolic and 70 or so diastolic increases the risk significantly of cardiovascular disease. So a blood pressure of 130 over 80, which most people would accept as a very normal blood pressure, still carries a significantly higher lifetime risk of cardiovascular disease than a blood pressure of, let's say, 110 or 115 over 65 or 70.
Yeah, and it's worth paying attention to because, again, off your website, it says six times more likely to develop congestive heart failure, seven times more likely to have a stroke if we have hypertension.
Correct. And we've been talking mostly about heart disease, but cardiovascular disease, which includes stroke, is extremely important to discuss. And the treatment of high blood pressure is very directly related to the development of stroke. Most strokes are caused by high blood pressure, at least in part.
Right.
And that's something that you can see a dramatic effect in terms of treatment and the reduction of stroke rates.
Right.
The other thing that's changed is we now have so many better ways of treating high blood pressure, and you mentioned non-pharmacologic means as well. And we know that a low-salt or reduced salt diet, a diet higher in potassium-rich foods such as fruits and vegetables, even by itself has a significant beneficial effect on reducing blood pressure. Controlling weight, exercise for sure can decrease blood pressure. All of these things are helpful. Reducing stress, which is not as easy to do as some of the other measures, also can be an important aspect of treatment.
Right.
Once we get beyond that, we have a great many varieties of medications. One of the things that was a detriment or deterrent, rather, to treating high blood pressure in the past was the fact that some of the medication that was being used years ago not only was not particularly effective, but tended to have significant side effects. And we're taking a condition which has no symptoms and giving a patient medication which causes symptoms has a net result in very frequently patients not taking the medication that's prescribed.
Right.
But now we've got quite a few medications which have minimal or no side effects, can be taken long-term without any adverse effects, and have been shown unequivocally to reduce the complications of hypertension.
So I want to talk about other symptoms of heart mm-hmm. disease that we might be able to, figure out ourselves before we get to the really serious stage. Shortness of breath, persistent coughing. What else, if we've got regularly, should we be paying attention to?
Well, certainly those. I think many people that I see, that we all see, are under the misconception that the classic symptoms of, let's say, a heart attack are the only ones they need to worry about. So a pain, pressure, or heavy sensation in the mid part of the chest radiating to the left arm associated with the shortness of breath, sweating, weakness, nausea, well, those are all classic symptoms of a heart attack. But that doesn't mean that every heart attack or angina symptom is necessarily the same. And there can be a lot of variation. And I think, it's incumbent upon us as physicians to be able to recognize the variation. One of the things which has been emphasized recently, and perhaps you were going to bring up, is the fact that symptoms often in women are different than symptoms mm-hmm. in men. And this is something that's been increasingly recognized over the last few years. And so that the classic symptoms aren't always present. It might be, let's say, facial pain or jaw pain or shoulder pain that might be misconstrued as a muscular pain, whereas, in fact, it could very well be a heart-related type symptom. Shortness of breath, as you mentioned, palpitations. They can be very nonspecific. And one of the key indications are that many of these symptoms in heart disease are brought on by physical exertion or even emotional stress, and that sometimes can be a clue as to the true nature of these symptoms. But it can be challenging sometimes, both for the individual with these symptoms and for the physician facing this individual trying to make the correct diagnosis. So I think awareness, again, on both the side of the person experiencing the symptoms and the physician treating or diagnosing the condition needs to be there. You need to think outside the box somewhat and realize that symptoms aren't always the classic ones that everybody's associated with heart disease.
Right. Now, is heart disease reversible? Given that we don't have major tears or need major surgery on our heart, if we've got heart disease, is it reversible as so many diet books claim?
Well, let's concentrate on coronary heart disease because I think we're mm-hmm. not going to talk about congenital heart disease
right.
or other forms, but coronary heart disease, which is the usual form of heart disease, to a large extent is reversible. I think probably what more accurately we can say that we can slow down and perhaps even arrest the process. Coronary disease is a very gradual disease, and most of the history of coronary disease is a latent period, an asymptomatic period where nobody is aware of the fact that plaque is building up in the arteries. And even there are no symptoms at that time, and even testing, let's say treadmill testing, exercise testing, may not pick up the fact that there is plaque building up in the arteries. Once it gets to a critical point, either because of progressive buildup of plaque in the artery or because of a sudden change in the nature of the plaque, such as a plaque rupture, which can occlude the artery, then symptoms will occur. But for many years, it's an asymptomatic stage. And particularly at this point, if we can recognize it with somewhat early testing, which we can get into as to how one does that, and you can apply the proper means to change lifestyle as well as perhaps medication, that process of buildup of arteriosclerosis can certainly be slowed way down and in certain cases even stopped. Whether it's truly reversible, I don't think we can make absolutely clean arteries out of arteries that have some plaque in them, but the point is that they can be reduced to the point where it's not a danger.
Interesting. I have a couple of true or false questions I want to ask you. we were told a glass of red wine helps us daily. Is that still true?
Still seems to be true, fortunately. So for those of us who enjoy red wine, we're in good company. The mechanism of that has been argued, and you know which particular component of it that's responsible is still debatable, but that does seem to be the case. So for men, 1 to 2 glasses of wine every day or two, and for women, 1 glass of wine every day or two seems to be a recommended regimen. Nobody is going out at this point and saying that if you don't drink, you should start drinking to prevent heart disease.
Right.
Because that has other foreseeable dangers in it. If one, like anything else, carries it to excess. But if you do enjoy wine, that's a good reason to encourage to continue to do so.
Yeah, and for quite some time, we see advertisements on television, commercials on television, saying take an aspirin a day, a baby junior aspirin
right.
a day. And contrary to that information, when I was researching, the British Heart Foundation and the American Heart Association are now saying the risks of taking an aspirin a day outweigh the possible benefits.
Yeah, that's an interesting question that has recently become, again, somewhat controversial. There were some studies early on, including physician's health study and nurse's health study, that seemed to show that a low-dose aspirin, 81 milligrams a day, which used to be called baby aspirin, is beneficial, both in terms of reducing heart disease and also colon cancer and perhaps a few other things. But aspirin, like any medication, is not totally benign, and aspirin can cause bleeding, gastrointestinal bleeding, and so people who have a tendency for bleeding or for gastrointestinal problems may wind up having more problems from taking aspirin than benefit. Like anything else, what we're trying to do is to really focus in on the individual risk. And so rather than saying that everybody in the country should be on an aspirin, everybody should be on a statin to reduce cholesterol, et cetera, I think if we can try to identify individual risk factors and see who is at risk for developing heart disease, the more risk factors you have, the more indication there is to do preventative treatment such as aspirin.
Mm.
So if you have a family history of heart disease, if you have controlled hypertension, if you have elevated cholesterol, if you have certain other risk factors that we can get into, then I think in those cases, aspirin is certainly indicated. Interestingly, aspirin in women seems to be more effective at stroke prevention than it is at heart attack prevention.
Oh, interesting.
And also, it seems to be more effective if it started later in life in women, that let's say at age 65, rather than men, in which case it's probably beneficial to start it, let's say at 50 or 55,
mm-hmm.
if not sooner. So that's there are some differences. And you know, let me just add to that the fact that women are catching up to men in terms of heart disease. And the difference is that they have about a 10 to 15 year benefit, so that heart disease is occurring much later, 10 to 15 years later in women in general than it is in men.
Yeah, I read the average age for onset of heart disease in women is around 70, whereas it's
right.
earlier for men. And another quick question, does menopausal hormone therapy increase a woman's risk for heart disease? Again, I found very controversial and differing opinions on that.
Yeah, and I think I don't think I can solve that controversy. Of course, when the women's heart study was done with hormone replacement therapy, it was everybody's big surprise. It came to everybody's surprise that hormone therapy started late menopausally in most of these women, seemed to increase the risk of heart disease rather than decrease it, which didn't make inherent sense because we always thought that perhaps a part of the reason for the delay in development of heart disease in women was due to the fact that there was protection in natural female hormones. There's a lot of reasons, and I think we probably don't want to spend the time to get into the theories as to why that didn't work out. But it is currently not recommended to start hormone therapy later in life, let's say many years after menopause. The same doesn't seem to hold true if women started immediately around the perimenopausal area. The danger does seem to not be as much of a concern there, particularly if it's only taken for a relatively short time, for let's say a few years to get through the period of symptoms, menopausal symptoms, and then probably stop it and take the lowest dose that reduces symptoms.
Interesting. Well, I want to thank you for being with us today. And what final thought would you like to leave our listeners with, Dr. Davidson?
February is Heart Month, and I think this is a good excuse. If you haven't been to the doctor recently for a checkup, if you haven't had your blood pressure and cholesterol checked, now is the time to do it. Do it this month.
There you go. And I know you're very busy. You run a full-time practice. You still teach. You still research. And I know you have a call today. So I really do appreciate you being with us today.
My pleasure. Very good questions, and I hope they were helpful.
Very, very. And you can find out more about Dr. Robert Davidson. His website is robertdavidsonmd.com. And he's got lots of really great patient education on that website. So take a look, robertdavidsonmd.com. Please do stay with us when we come back. We'll be getting close up and personal with Brandy Aubrey. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
Coming next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, Gloria Felt says 2012 will be the year of the woman and asks, will you be ready? Named one of America's top 200 leaders by Vanity Fair and Woman of the Year by Glamour Magazine, Felt is the author of No Excuses, 9 Ways Women Can Change the Way They Think About Power. We'll also talk with Joyce Stevens, why baby boomers might want to rethink starting a nonprofit. Tune in Monday at noon Pacific on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, right here on Alternative Talk 1150. See more at conversationslive.net.
Women of the world, take over.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL. Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
Whether you want to write for business, for pleasure, or for publication, there's writing that works and writing that doesn't. So stop procrastinating and start today. Sign up for Writing That Gets Results with Vicki St. Clair and put your words to work. Vicki is a multidisciplinary writer, author, and communications consultant, and in 4 hands-on workshop sessions can help you focus your thoughts, identify your market, create your outline, and find your voice. Call Vicki St. Clair for full details at 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617. Or email info@conversationslive.net.
If you want to reach a large audience of like-minded people, people with integrity, people who strive to live well and live strong, let Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair shine a spotlight on your message. Tell us about your business, product, service, or event, and we'll help you craft your message and promote your good work. Email Vicky at conversationslive.net or call 425-269-4772. That's 425-269-4772. Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
Spread the word. Your favorite shows are on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back, everyone. We're in the last segment of today's show, and we're talking about heart disease. More women die of heart disease than the second, third, and fourth leading causes of death combined, and that includes all forms of cancer. And we have Brandy Aubrey joining us right now. She lives in Seattle. She's just 34 years old and has lived with heart disease all of her life. She survived open heart surgery, and I'm going to bring her on right now. She's going to share her journey with us. Brandy Aubrey, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Vicky.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And I got connected with you through Go Red for Women, who then contacted their, it's a movement to do with the heart.org, the American Heart Association. And you're one of their survivor spokespeople, as I understand it. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yes, actually, it's pretty funny. I was at a local Seattle Storm women's basketball game, and it was Heart Health Night, and I was approached by someone from the Heart Association who noticed my scar from open heart surgery, and we chatted for a little while, and I told her my story of growing up with heart disease, and they approached me and asked me if I'd be willing to join the Go Red for Women movement and act as an ambassador for the program. So I go around and I speak and share my story.
And I love that you don't cover up your scar. It's a big 7-inch scar right in the middle of your chest there, and I love that you do not cover that up.
Oh, it's huge, yeah. It's it goes right down the center of my chest. It's 7 inches long, and just below it, I actually have an additional small X scar from having a drainage tube. So if you actually look at my chest, I now have a exclamation point permanently carved into my body. So if that doesn't make a statement, I don't know what does.
And it helps to have a sense of humor there.
Definitely.
So let's talk a little bit about your journey, Brandy, because I think it helps relate when we can put a personal face on heart disease and what it means to people and their families. You have a family history of preventable heart disease, but yours was something entirely different. You were just 3 years old, I believe, when you were diagnosed. So tell us about that.
Yes, when I was about 2.5, my parents took me in to my regular doctor, and he heard a heart murmur. And a lot of people have heart murmurs. That's where you have that extra heartbeat. So instead of boom, 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 my heart sounded ba-ba-boom, ba-ba-boom. My doctor was listening to it and thought there might be something more going on and sent me over to the doctors at Children's, where I was diagnosed with something called bicuspid valve aortic stenosis. And what that means is my aortic valve, instead of having the 3 flaps that open all the way, I only had 2 flaps on my valve, so it didn't open all the way. And over time, like with any other muscle, the heart, when it's working hard, it gets thicker. So if you think about kind of like a garden hose, and the garden hose is getting thicker and thicker, that's narrowing the opening for the blood flow to go through. And so all the oxygenated blood in my body would, as my heart was working harder, would therefore start getting backed up into my heart, and I wouldn't get oxygenated blood through the rest of my body.
Mm-hmm.
So we were told when I was about 2.5 that at some point, I would have to have open heart surgery. I would have to have that valve replaced. But it's a very high-risk procedure, obviously. So they try and put it off as long as possible and monitor it. So I grew up having once a year exams at Children's to check and see if my valve was narrowing very much yet.
Mm-hmm. And I understand at age 23, you started getting dizzy spells. You were lightheaded, tightness in the chest, and then burning on the left side of the neck, jaw pain, blackouts, all the classic symptoms that we think of with heart disease and heart attack. But the cardiologist told you that young women tend to overreact and to go away.
Yes, pretty much. I was having all these symptoms. My blood pressure had always been extremely low, and it was getting higher. I was even getting nosebleeds and heart palpitations. And I went in, and my doctor actually patted me on the knee and said, "Oh, honey, young women tend to overreact. I'm sure you're fine. Come back in 3 to 5 years or when you have a real symptom."
Mm-hmm.
Women tend to be stressed, so I'm sure it's just stress. Learn to manage your stress better and go away.
Interesting. I hope you didn't go back to him. But
sadly, I actually did.
Oh, no.
I listened to him. And, you know, when everybody else is telling you you're probably just stressed and the doctors are, and I listened to him. And over the next few years, the symptoms kept getting worse. And it was getting to the point where I was, you know, blacking out, and it was affecting my work. And so I went back in and said, "Hey, this is, you know, this is what's going on. We know I have a heart problem. This is textbook." And he chuckled and said, "Well, maybe it's a seizure disorder. Maybe it's a brain tumor. I don't think it's really your heart." And sent me away, and I was put on anti-seizure medications for seizures I wasn't having. And my heart symptoms kept getting worse. So we went back in again and got taken off the seizure medications. And I did not go back to a doctor for a couple of years because everyone kept telling me I was just too stressed out and I need to learn to manage my stress better.
Yeah. Do you know how many funerals I've been to people who've been told that by a doctor and had something very seriously wrong with them?
Well, exactly. And what we didn't know at the time was, well, flash forward, at the age of 31, I'm having dinner with some friends and I get a spider bite on the back of my leg. I go into my doctor the next day because it's become this huge softball-sized welt, and I was told, "Well, there's good news and bad news. The good news is you have MRSA, and we can treat that with antibiotics." And I said, "My goodness, if the good news is MRSA, what's the bad news?" They said, "Well, we think your heart's gone very bad. Your blood pressure is 189 over 129. We can only find it on one side of your body. We can't find it on the other. And your heart is beating at 99 beats a minute right now. So you're at risk for not being alive through the end of this weekend. We need to get you to a cardiologist now."
Well, thank goodness for that spider bite.
Exactly. When my new cardiologist did tests, they found that I was in advanced heart failure. My valve was failing, and I had an aneurysm that was wrapping around my aorta right where it attached to the heart. So if that had ruptured, it would have ripped my entire aorta away from my heart, and I would have bled out very quickly.
Well, you knew you'd got heart disease, but I read that 2/3 of women who actually die of a heart attack experience no prior symptoms. So,
exactly, and that's what's really scary. You know, you need to really be your own advocate. And if you think something's wrong and the one doctor tells you that you're okay, you need to really get a second opinion. So,
yeah.
Now, yeah.
In December 2008, you had open heart surgery. They replaced your heart valve and aorta. You say you've never been healthier. You've never felt better. I think you get a little bit of mileage out of the 7-inch scar from reading your website. You said even on dates.
Yeah, I'm single. I'm 34. And my entire life, I grew up kind of hiding my heart condition from people because they treated me differently. And with the giant scar now, I can't hide it. I mean, it's there. You see it. So I'll never forget my first date after open heart. I was wearing a tank top. It was in the summer. And my date just kept staring at my chest. And
as they normally would.
Like, wow, is he checking out the girls? Is he checking out the scar? And then he asked about it. And I told him, and very matter of fact, and okay, here's what happened. Move on. And he actually sat there and looked at me, and he goes, "What'd they replace it with?" I said, "Well, some pig parts, but I'm healthy now. I'm good." The rest of the date, when he just didn't know what to say, I'd catch him staring at my chest, and he'd oink at me. And I was like, yeah, so it has not gone well for dating, but I'm not going to hide it. It's part of who I am. I see my scar as a badge of honor. I survived.
And we're glad.
I came very close to not surviving. When I was being put onto a heart-lung bypass, my aneurysm actually did start to rupture.
Right.
So if they'd, my surgery had been 1 hour later, I would not have made it.
Well, I thank you for being here with us. And I think, you know, one lesson I'm taking away from this, from the conversation with you, is, you know, go get a second opinion. And if you feel something's wrong with you, don't just take the doctor's answer. We're right at the end of our segment here. But I want to say first of all, a big thank you to you, Brandy, for sharing your journey with us and being so honest. And also, I want to thank the American Heart Association. You can find a wealth of information at theheart.org, and goredforwomen.org, which is a movement by the American Heart Association, of which Brandy is part. And if you're an educator, I also wanted to just point out on the heart.org site, there are some great heart educational materials for the classroom. So want to just leave you with a couple of thoughts here that these are facts I got from Swedish and various other heart associations, that women are less likely than men to believe they're having a heart attack and more likely to delay in seeking emergency treatment, which might explain why 2/3 of women who die of a heart attack had no previous experience, and that's where they end up, unfortunately. So pay attention, and if you're in doubt, call 911. Thank you so much for being with us today. You can find out more information at conversationslive.net. You can reach me at info@conversationslive.net. See you next week.